From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today on the program, we'll talk to the author of a study on whether 100% renewable energy would have supplied enough power to survive the polar vortex. He says we need a way to store power.
Just looking at polar vortex week alone, that you could potentially need battery energy storage that could last between 18 and 40 hours.
We talk about reforming no-fault auto insurance with our political commentators.
We have the best coverage in the country, but we also have the highest rates, and they go together.
We hear the story of one of West Point's early African-American graduates and his experiences in the Army.
In 1948, Truman integrated the armed forces. Before that time, units in the military were segregated.
Plus, our artisan of Michigan is a philosophic stonemason.
You know, I like the stone to be a stone, natural stone.
Plus, we'll talk to the Germac Pistachio Company, marking 95 years in Detroit. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, the recent polar vortex provided a great opportunity to find out how a 100% renewable energy grid would have fared during those frigid days in late January. We'll talk with a researcher who crunched the data. Plus, Germac Pistachio Company celebrates 95 years in Detroit this week.
My grandfather decided to focus just on pistachios, and he felt that there'd be enough of a market with pistachios in the United States.
Those stories coming up later in this hour. But first, Michigan, on average, has the highest auto insurance rate in the nation. Lawmakers in Lansing plan to once again try to reform Michigan's no-fault auto insurance laws. There are powerful lobbies at work, including the auto insurance companies, health insurance companies, hospitals, trial lawyers, survivors of catastrophic auto crashes and their families. Joining me to talk about all of that are our Friday political commentators. Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican Senate Majority Leader. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state legislator. Ken, it seems like this issue has been debated for decades. What are the big issues in an effort to lower auto insurance rates?
Well, it has been debated for decades. I remember when I was first elected to the House 35 years ago, I was on the insurance committee in my first term, and we were debating the high cost of auto insurance in Michigan and why it was so high and what could be done to fix it, and it hasn't been fixed. Probably one of the biggest issues, not the only issue, is that medical costs. When Michigan's no-fault law was put into place in the early 70s, the medical cost of lifetime medical benefits was less than 10% of your annual premium. And now it's over 40%. And so it's the ever-rising cost of medical care that is a big contributor to the fact that Michigan has the highest rates in the country.
Vicki, has there ever been a proposal to reform no-fault auto insurance that approached a solution?
Well, I think we're getting closer and closer and closer, but the short answer is no, and that's why we haven't had a solution. If you've ever seen the catastrophic results of a car crash with somebody with a brain injury, especially a young person, and the care that they need for the rest of their lives, it's overwhelming. And the fact that when we first started No Fault, the goal was to have no lawsuits in exchange for unlimited health care. And that was the goal, to drive down the cost of auto insurance. But as Ken said, the cost of health care is escalating. And that's a real problem. It's not just a problem for auto insurance. It's a problem for homeowners insurance and everything we do that's related to some component of health care.
Well, I have met some of those people who were really badly hurt in car crashes, and they and their family are so thankful for having insurance that covers the cost of surgery and rehabilitation and the support they might need for the rest of their life because of permanent injuries. Ken, this is exceptional coverage. It's the best in the nation. Should it be scrapped or capped in order to lower auto insurance rates?
Well, it is the best in the nation, but that's also why our rates are the highest in the nation. I mean, they go together. I want to support two points that Vicki made. One is that the concept in the early 70s to go to no fault was that we wouldn't have any lawsuits. We wouldn't clog up the courts with auto-related lawsuits, And that hasn't happened. There are a lot of lawsuits, ever-increasing number of them, even under Michigan's no-fault law. So that hasn't worked. The other thing that Vicky said that I think she's right about is the timing is probably as good as it's going to be, or at least as good as it's been for many years, to do something about this. You know, it's just not sustainable to have this kind of expensive rates. You got 20% of Michigan motorists are driving without auto insurance because of it.
You know, some of the solutions that I've talked to in the past, there's Detroit Mayor Duggan's D-insurance idea, which would substantially cut the benefits. There was also the idea that I believe Governor Snyder proposed, and that was capping it at $1 million worth of coverage. Do any of those make sense? I mean, if we're going to have lower rates, we've got to give up something. What do we give up, Vicky?
Well, that's the problem. We shouldn't have to give up the coverage for unlimited medical. And some of the solutions that were proposed in the past said you could pick your level of coverage. Well, that's great, but if my auto insurance, I want full PIP protection, personal injury protection, and I'm paying for that in my auto insurance, but I'm riding in a car with somebody who's paying for minimal insurance and they're in a car crash, am I not covered under my insurance when I want the highest level? What happens to seniors who are on Medicare and the whole idea was, well, we'll cut their rates because they already have unlimited health care? What happens if they're driving with a grandchild in the car? What happens to that grandchild if they're permanently disabled from a car crash? That's one thing. The other thing that if we're going to talk about gas taxes and all of those other things, for about 15 cents a gallon, I believe, you can cover that PIP rate and put the auto insurance, personal protection insurance, inside of the gasoline tax. So the people that drive the most are paying the most. And every driver, whether you are in Detroit or wherever you are paying. And if you come into our state and are driving a vehicle and you buy gas, you're paying. And that would substantially lower rates. I also want to point out that they're looking at fee schedules for the health insurance coverage, but they're not looking at fee schedules for the repair coverage of a car. And we have to look at it in total.
The health care part is big. And even the health care industry has, you know, they haven't said absolutely no to a fee schedule, but they don't want it to be something to the equivalent of some of the cheaper ones. Like, you know, they want something better than workman's comp. Does that make sense, Ken?
Well, I think you have to have a fee schedule. You know, 35 years ago, that was kind of a question I had when I first began to understand this a little bit, that the auto insurance system, when it comes to medical coverage, is probably the only one left that doesn't have some kind of fee schedule. And I think that has to be part of it. And there are a lot of issues here in terms of how rates are determined. But it just seems to me, bottom line, if you're going to reduce rates, you're going to have to reduce coverage.
Let me ask you this, and I want you to be as candid as possible. If auto no-fault is reformed, what guarantee will we have for significantly lower rates, and will they stay significantly lower? Vicky?
No, and that's the problem. There have been promises of lowering them for the first 3 years, but the other part of this problem that we're really not talking about is when we went to no-fault auto insurance, the insurance companies who had a phased-in coverage rate of health care, which eventually went up to they're responsible for the first $550,000 in medical, and a lot of people are hitting that cap because of health care inflation, they created a reinsurance pool called the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Fund, and that's where this PIP insurance money goes to cover a pool of recipients who are receiving care beyond the $550,000. That is a black hole at this moment with tons and tons and billions of dollars in it that we have, the state has no control over, can't look at, can't ask the insurance companies how they determine the rate structure for insurance policies. And we believe that there's over $22-23 billion in that fund, but we can't find out. We don't know what their actuarial numbers are in determining who gets coverage and how long, which is the paper number they use to create this dollar figure that goes on your auto insurance. And we really need to get into that. But most of the plans that have been suggested for auto no-fault reform return that money in the catastrophic claims fund to insurance companies, not ratepayers. So the billions of dollars that would be distributed out of the catastrophic claims fund, the beneficiaries are the insurance companies, the auto insurance companies. And that's why they are pushing so hard for no-fault reform.
Just to clarify where the $22 billion, $23 billion comes from, right now you're paying $162 per year per car to go into the MCCA fund. Okay, Ken, last word. If auto no-fault is reformed, any guarantee we'll have lower rates?
Well, the only way to guarantee that is to have government, some government entity approve rates on an annual basis, and that gets into a very philosophical debate between probably Republicans and Democrats whether that's a good idea or not. But I just go back to kind of the basic premise. We have the best coverage in the country, but we also have the highest rates, and they go together.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican lawmaker. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic lawmaker. Thanks very much. Happy March.
I can't believe the year's flying by so fast.
Thanks, Lester.
We like to hear from you. So what stories are you interested in right now? What issues do you want to hear more about right here on the radio? Let us know. Send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and, of course, at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Coming up, we talk with retired Army officer Clifford Worthy. His new book outlines his military career starting in the late 1940s before desegregation.
In 1948, Truman integrated the armed forces. Before that time, units in the military were segregated. Even black units were commanded by white officers.
That conversation after the break. This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Before desegregation in the armed forces in 1948, very few African Americans were given the opportunity to attend West Point. My next guest started his journey toward West Point prior to that desegregation. He's written a book about that and his military career, but it's also a book about family and faith. The title is The Black Knight, An African American Family's Journey from West Point, A Life of Duty, Honor, and Country. The author is Clifford Worthy, and he joins us now. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The foreword of your book was written by the recently departed John Dingell Jr. What was your connection to the former representative?
John Dingell Jr. was the son of John Dingell Sr., who was the one who appointed me to West Point in 1949.
Yeah, John Dingell Sr. was a congressman until 1955,
yes.
So yeah. Historically, how were the handful of African Americans who went to West Point treated?
They were what was called silenced. No one spoke to them. They stayed in a room by themselves. They ate by themselves. The only contact they had with the other cadets was through academics and military training. But other than that, they were isolated, so to speak.
Having heard that, I'm wondering what your time was like at West Point.
Well, I think West Point took seriously the edict that came from President Truman. In 1948, Truman integrated the armed forces. Before that time, units in the military were segregated. even black units were commanded by white officers. So it was that was the situation. Now, when I got there, I think West Point had got the message, even though there had been resistance, obviously, at that time. But I never felt any serious problem with racism while I was there.
And that, you got there in 1949.
1949, we should say. Yeah.
The primary title is The Black Knight. What does that mean?
Well, the motto or the much like Michigan Wolverines, cadets were
so
called.
The cadets, the Black Knights.
Black Knights.
You did run into some Jim Crow incidents while you're early in the service, not in the Army base itself, but traveling in the South and the West. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about one of those experiences?
Yeah, one of those was we were traveling going from Detroit at that time to Camp Carson. It was called Camp Carson. Now it's Fort Carson. It took us through a little town called Clayton, New Mexico. When we got there, we needed gas, and so I stopped at a gas station, asked the attendant if where we could get something to eat. Clearly, he saw that we were black, but he didn't indicate it made a difference to him. So he just told us the name of a restaurant, a local restaurant, that we were there. I still had my New York license plate on my car, and so we went to this restaurant, and as I walked in the front door, it was a very cheery, lively group of people there, and they were having a good time, typically. But as soon as I walked in the door, everything went dead silent. Even the people, the black people who were keeping the place clean stopped and stared. Well, I knew, kind of figured I was in trouble. Well, I left my wife out in the car because back in those days, you had to take those kinds of precautions, particularly in the South. The lady that served me, she flabbergasted that I would even be there. She said, "Don't you know you're not supposed to be here, boy? You know, you go around to the back." And she was really upset. For some strange reason, the manager or the owner said, "Go ahead and give him what he wants." And that really set her off. And she threw the hamburgers at me that I had ordered. And as I was about to leave, you could hear the chairs in the. And as I walked out the door, there was people clearly following me outside. I went back, got in the car, drove, and I knew I was in trouble because if I looked behind me, there's a pickup truck, the lights start flashing, and there was like a convoy of people, a truck behind me. I couldn't get any help because if it was a chief of police there, he probably would have been leading the convoy. Anyway, I started to drive away, and they followed me down the road. But I got to a point, and for some reason, they stopped and started turning around. But I assumed it was because I was near the border. But anyway, that was a scary moment because I had no idea what would have happened had I not been at that particular spot.
Did you face any kind of racism in the military in the 1950s or 1960s?
Not that I'm aware of. Now, I know that's hard to believe. Kind of subtly, yes. For instance, during the summer as a cadet, we would go to different bases for training purposes. And I remember being in El Paso, Texas, going there and going across the border to Juarez with my classmates, being refused service even there in Mexico. And clearly it wasn't the service. It was just the policy at that time. So there were other similar instances like that. There used to be social programs by these little towns that we would visit. One time we were going to one little town and they were giving a party for the cadets as they came in. They bussed in the girls from the town for the cadets. But in our case, we were given staff cars, pick up our dates, which for a change was to our advantage. But that kind of thing took place.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book, as I was reading, that there were a couple of bases where you were suddenly found that all of the black families lived in one block on base, things like that. And I just thought, wow, that's hard to excuse after desegregation, right? You did a couple of stints overseas. One was in Germany during the Cold War in 1957. Mm-hmm. The other was in Vietnam in 1968. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from those experiences?
I learned, one, how resourceful the American GIs are. You know, it wasn't the Hollywood-type shoot 'em up type things you should see about Vietnam. I saw that too. But it was just how American soldiers were able to cope with whatever the situation was, find a solution to whatever problem they were faced with. That was one thing that impressed me, and there are many others.
Let's talk about your family, because your family, for the most part, moved from Army base to Army base. Of course, they didn't go to Vietnam, but they did go with you to Germany and spent some time there. Your first child, Mark, was born with special needs, and being in the military, that was difficult for you and especially difficult for your wife, Lillian. Lillian passed away fairly early in your life. You also have two daughters, Kim and Jennifer. Most of us know about Kim Worthy because of her work as Wayne County prosecutor. So Lillian died while your daughters were in school, Jennifer in high school, Kim in college. How did that affect you and your kids?
Well, unfortunately, my wife came up with a medical condition that she was losing. Her balance was deteriorating, and she had some difficulty in negotiating steps. And anyway, our next-door neighbor at the time was the post, a neurosurgeon, and he examined her and decided that she had undue pressure in the vertebrae.
Yeah.
And so he recommended some surgery, but he wanted me to get a second opinion. So he sent me to the University of Oklahoma Medical Center in Oklahoma City, which is about 100 miles away. And the doctor there just decided the same thing and decided for surgery. I mention that because at that time, Kim was at the University of Michigan. And based on the information I'd had at that time, I didn't see there was any need for her to leave school to come to Oklahoma where we were. And that might have been a bad decision because Kim, when she lost her mother, which what happened, they had did the surgery. She was paralyzed from the neck down, and they went back in and did the same thing, but it never helped. And of course, Kim was upset with me because I was never told about it, and the kids. I guess it was the minimal effect on my daughter, Jennifer, at the time. But later on, you could see that she had missed her mom. She was 14 years old when her mom died. That was a problem for her. And, of course, for Kim was a problem because she felt that she should have known. In fact, she really wanted to accuse the surgeon of malpractice. Back in those days, you just took the surgeon's word. You didn't think about those things much.
As we've been talking, you've been rising in the ranks. Mm-hmm. By this point, you're a full bird colonel. Mm-hmm. You worked in the Pentagon, including serving with the Undersecretary of the Army. In all likelihood, you were on your way to becoming a general, but you retired. Why?
Well, I retired because I had a 14-year-old daughter and a son that needed help. And I felt that I could be going all around the world with children who needed help and where help was not always available. And I thought best for them was for me to retire. So I did.
So I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I'm wondering, as an author, what do you want us to take from this book more than anything else?
I want young people, particularly young African-American kids, to know that sometimes things just happen. Sometimes opportunities are thrust upon you, much like it was for me. And you've got to be ready to stand in and take advantage of it. And then also I want them to understand that bad things happen. And I've mentioned bad things. We've talked about them here. People are, you know, particularly back in those days, that was pre-Martin Luther King days. But there were good people.
We're not completely away from them.
Yeah. But there were some wonderful people that helped me along the way that were not at that time. And the doors opened for me, and I think I wanted the kids to know you have to take some risks sometime. And I was fortunate enough to do that and ended up with assignments like being sent to the University of Arizona for 2 years to get a master's in mechanical engineering, commanding a field artillery battalion in Vietnam, going to the Pentagon and being a part of the Chief of Research and Development for a while, and then becoming one of the military assistants to the Undersecretary of the Army, had tremendous assignments.
Yeah, those doors open, but you have to walk through,
through them. That's right. And yeah. I could go on and on. But you've got to walk through them. You've got to be willing to stand and take a chance and take advantage of those opportunities and treat them as achievable, not just saying, well, I'll never make it. You can make it.
We've been speaking to Clifford Worthy. He's written his life story in the book The Black Knight, An African-American Family's Journey from West Point, A Life of Duty, Honor, and Country. Sir, thanks very much for sharing your book with us, and thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we've got another addition to our popular series, Artisans of Michigan. This time, our artisan is in Ann Arbor. Tom Filecki is showing me some of his work. He's a stonemason, and he's been at it for nearly 50 years.
And it took me 30 to really figure it out. Now, that sounds crazy, but once I figured it out, oh, my God, it wasn't as frustrating.
Filecki says up until that point, he was doing the work and nobody complained.
Well, I did their same style that these guys did. And there's a book that I got, and I recommend it to a lot of students. It's The Art of Stonework. It's from a Scotchman. I don't know if he's still alive. His name is Ian Cram. And you'll follow his basic stuff, and that's all it is. You know, it started evolving. And once I got going, it was so cool.
By the way, Ian Cram's book's correct title is The Art of the Stonemason. We'll have a link to it online. Filecki says in part, he just lets the stone be a stone. He doesn't chip away at it to reshape it, and he doesn't turn his stones on end. He doesn't like the vertical lines, and he says it weakens the structure. He lays the stone flat, fills in the spaces with small stones when needed, but he's looking for horizontal lines as he shows me on his house.
See how lineal it is?
Mm-hmm.
And the way I try to teach my students, you level up and you go over. You see, you get rid of those vertical joints. I taught a class at Washtenaw about 18 years ago. I had 16 people and a grandma. And I taught her how to split stone. Oh, these guys just loved it, and she did too. But I have, you know, just basic rules that I follow. Everything's laid down. There's nothing standing up here. See the corners?
Right.
Tie it in. And, okay, you can definitely see the pieces in there, but I lay the stone like it is. In other words, I don't do all these weird cuts.
It looks like a big jigsaw puzzle, a really complex one.
Yeah, but it's, you know, you just start laying and it takes over. And it's fun.
How he places the stones is important to him, but so is the other material a stonemason uses.
Yeah, I think is really important is the mortar mix I use. I make my own mortar. And I use a coarse sand, about 3/4 lime, and about 1/4 cement. And what that is, it's a weaker mixture. It doesn't sound right. But what it does is it's self-healing if the wall is moving.
In what way?
Well, if it moves, the mortar will tend to move with it.
So it's got a little flexibility.
Little flexibility. The modern mortars don't have that.
Filecki says he really got to the point where being a stonemason didn't seem to be such a job as it was before.
And you're always improving on yourself.
Why do you enjoy it?
Just the outside, and it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I like outside, but, you know, November on, I hate it. Just despise it. Can't make any money. You know, you're putting up plastic, everything's got to be heated. It's awful. It's awful.
There are a lot of stone structures in Ann Arbor, a lot of stone churches, and Filecki has worked on additions to some of those buildings.
I helped fix St. Thomas Church, and I looked at the stonemasons 100 years ago. Beautiful work, but they got these really long vertical joints. So I'm looking at this, and they got cracks in it, so they didn't know everything. But they were strong farm boys. I could never pick up those stones.
He's a little skeptical of where the trade is going. Besides a trowel, he basically has one tool he uses, a stone splitter. It's kind of like if a dull axe and a sledgehammer had a baby. The thing is really heavy. He says he's watched as one of today's stonemasons took a different approach.
They drill a bunch of holes in them. The stone's only this big. Drill a bunch of holes in it, then they tap that, then it breaks. Now, give me that stone, I have it done in 20 seconds with my splitter. I used to split 4 tons a day.
What do you think about the future? Are there a lot of youngsters who are doing good stone work, or is it a dying art?
No, they're doing all cultured stone. In other words, it's a fake stone, I call it. I wish I could just go to those guys, and I can give them some tips. Show them how to make it look like real stone.
Tom Filecki is past retirement age, but he's still stacking stone. He's been working on a wall of boulders at his driveway entrance. It's the border for a raised flower garden. He lets the equipment do a lot of the work these days, but it still takes a trained eye to know when it's right.
You know, I like the stone to be a stone, natural stone.
That's Tom Filecki, stonemason and our latest Artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, the first American company to roast pistachios is right here in Michigan, Detroit's Germac Pistachio Company. After the break, we'll learn more about the company's 95 years in the nut business. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The recent polar vortex offered a surprise in Michigan. We were all asked to lower our thermostats because a fire at a natural gas compression station caused problems. It revealed some weaknesses in our natural gas distribution system. Well, that cold snap also gave an energy consultant firm a unique opportunity to study the demand for electricity in detail. The study from Wood Mackenzie is titled Performance Review, Nuclear, Fossil Fuels, and Renewables During the 2019 Polar Vortex. Wade Schauer is a co-author of that report, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lester.
So when you reviewed power demand, what were you looking for?
Well, we were looking to see how different generating technologies performed during this recent cold snap. We would like to, you know, better understand if these things were to happen in the future with different mixes of resources, you know, how would the power system perform or what kind of mitigation measures might be needed under those circumstances?
Right, because most of the utilities in the state have committed to changing their sources of fuel, greater reliance on renewable energy such as wind and solar. You looked at what might have happened if we were completely reliant on renewables. What did you find?
Well, you know, Michigan is part of the larger Mid-Continent ISO area, and what we found was that on the day where the polar vortex first hit, wind generation in MISO was doing quite well. There, you know, as you would expect, when a cold front comes through, the wind speeds are high, and as a result, wind generation was very high. But the following day, when the temperatures actually became even colder, the wind generation and the wind speeds collapsed, pretty much down to like sub 10% capacity factors. And so other resources in the northern part of MISO had to step in during those gaps. And this is not kind of unexpected. You know, you expect wind to be intermittent, but it just kind of highlights that if you were to rely more and more on that type of resource, you would have to have other alternatives to fossil fuels to back it up, whether it be some type of energy storage or importing more power from distant regions or that type of thing.
Yeah, help us understand that a little bit, because your report says any mix of wind and solar to serve the load would require long-duration storage or optimization of multiple stages of shorter duration. Does that mean batteries? Does that mean some kind of service that stores the power of energy? Like I've heard of things like if you've got a lot of sun, you could pump some water up a hill, and then at night you can use that to turn turbines when it comes back down. What kind of things are you talking about?
Yeah, so just looking at the polar vortex week alone, that you could potentially need batteries, energy storage that could last between 18 and 40 hours so that if you're basically charging it with surplus wind and solar during the first part of the period and then using it for that gap of output. So there's a variety of possibilities. You know, there's existing pump storage plants like you talk about, but most of the proposed energy storage these days, like the vast majority of it, would be batteries. And typically today you're only talking about 3 to 4 hours of duration with batteries, so it would have to be something with much longer durations once you start approaching high levels of renewables. Other possibilities that are talked about are things like converting a surplus solar and wind to hydrogen and then using that in either in the gas network or some other way of delivering that hydrogen to power plants that would then convert it back into electricity. The last thing that a lot of people talk about is energy efficiency. You know, if everybody, you know, put in the maximum amount of insulation in their homes, if you put in, you know, the best windows and the best heat pumps and all these kind of things, you know, you could lower the energy demand a lot, not completely, but to a great extent, which would then help with the problem of what would provide those resources in the future.
Now, the idea here is eliminate fossil fuel plants, no coal, no natural gas, so there are fewer greenhouse gases being released. Nuclear, putting aside the other issues with nuclear, is also a greenhouse gas-free power source. What role did nuclear play into your calculations?
So nuclear performed extremely well during the polar vortex. There was just one plant outage in New Jersey that got a lot of press, but as the fleet as a whole in that footprint that was hit by the polar vortex was operating at about a 98% or higher capacity factor, so very good during the event. What we found is interesting is a lot of people talk about nuclear is kind of blocking renewable generation from expanding. You can make that argument in one sense, that if nuclear wasn't there, you could absorb more wind generation, for example, at times. But what we actually found was that by having nuclear in the fleet, you would obviously have less renewables that you would need to build, and you would also have less energy storage that you would need to build to store that energy.
Right, and we'd also have to have some place to put this nuclear waste that we don't have a place for. I got to ask you,
That's
you know,
right.
Because everybody is suspicious of anything that runs counter to what they believe. Was your study funded by any industry?
No, it was not.
So what was the intended audience for this?
Well, at Wood Mackenzie, we have a variety of clients. We have power plants that have coal assets, power plants that have nuclear, gas, wind, solar. We have kind of runs the gamut. The intention was just that with all of this talk about 100% renewable energy that has occurred in the last couple of months, we thought it would be a good idea to start thinking about what the implications of that would be in the next 10 or 20 years if that were to happen. So the best way to do that is to take actual data, which is what we did. We were using the actual hourly demand, wind, solar, coal, gas generation numbers that were coming out of these different ISOs and just looking at what would happen. And then extrapolating that is if you scaled up the wind and solar to kind of 100% levels.
Sounds like your recommendation, or if you made a recommendation, it sounds like you were looking at the big problem is we just don't have storage, and that's the next big hurdle for a renewable energy grid?
Storage is definitely a key component of what it will take. The other thing will be potentially a large amount of transmission expansion of the power grid so that you can move power from farther areas where maybe you have an oversupply of wind or solar to areas that are currently facing a deficit. But the challenge with this transmission is not necessarily the technical attribute of it. It's the fact that so many people are opposed to seeing any transmission lines near their homes and things. So we find that those kind of projects can take 10 to 20 years to build and often get derailed completely because of public opposition.
Wade Schauer is Research Director at America's Power and Renewables at Wood Mackenzie. He is co-author of the study Performance Review, Nuclear, Fossil Fuels, and Renewables During the 2019 Polar Vortex. Thanks for telling us about your report.
Oh, thank you, Lester, for having me.
Doreen O'Brien brings exquisite art and an unsentimental heart to characters in her short story collection, What It Might Feel Like to Hope, published by Baobab Press. That's according to fellow Michigan writer Laura Thomas, who has this review of the Detroit author's latest book.
The 11 stories in this compelling collection spar with the courage and downright obstinacy of independent-minded people who refuse to let hardships, or just plain bad luck, whittle away their idealism. The stories take place in Detroit, and small towns across the upper Midwest. And O'Brien's cast is as varied and determined as her gritty settings. An herbalist dispenses tough love about the dangers of Cheetos, along with her healing dandelion tea. A tarot card reader schemes to save Detroit from blight and casinos. An Alzheimer's diagnosis leads a research scientist to find new meaning in the crystals he can no longer study. Story by story, line by line, O'Brien reveals that forging our own destinies when circumstances elude our control is the collection's real meaning of hope. Many of O'Brien's stories portray hope not as the brass ring up for grabs, but as an intentional practice for survival. In the story Falling Forward, a grieving woman finds new purpose by repeatedly bailing her drunken, ne'er-do-well neighbor from jail. When Faith convinces Ed to release his pet lizard from captivity, O'Brien's deft descriptions make us feel that Faith and Ed's leap into their new futures isn't so much redemption, but a mandate to embrace the freedom to feel pain. In another story titled Harm None, a woman whose husband is missing in action in Vietnam pledges to live with her mother-in-law, that tough love herbalist, until her husband comes home. The women survive both financial struggles and a loss of faith by building a successful herbal tea business that practices another of the collection's themes, that, quote, energy sent to sick people did not replace their responsibility for their own well-being, but simply kicked their own healing into gear. O'Brien also writes eloquently of how our bodies play turncoat in heartbreaking ways. In the collection's title story, a repressed mortician who is, quote, keenly aware of how a body can turn on a person without notice, learns that he must pierce his professional detachment in order to feel the hope only raw grief can bring. And in the story titled Honesty Above All Else, Detroit is the body, and the corruption that leads to blight is the betrayal. Woven into her collection's generous tapestry of minds, bodies, and places, O'Brien's characters share one common past. They have all built their earlier lives on faith. Since hope once gave them the moxie to get where they are in life, the search to feel hope again gives these stories a practical and a spiritual heft beyond the typical redemption narrative. In What It Might Feel Like to Hope, faith is not an ephemeral force, but the bootstrap that gets the job done. O'Brien's insightful, beautiful writing and exquisite attention to craft do the same.
What It Might Feel Like to Hope book launch is this Saturday at the Detroit Public Library on Woodward Avenue. Our reviewer, Laura Thomas, heads the creative writing program at the University of Michigan's Presidential College. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, the people who helped popularize pistachios in America celebrate their 95th year of business. Germack Pistachio Company in Detroit started in 1924. Joining us is the grandson of the founder, Frank Germack III. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk a little bit about history. Your company started out as basically a grocer, catering to immigrant families from the Mediterranean region. So tell me what kind of products you were selling back then.
Sure. So in my grandfather's time, they were importing a lot of products from the region. This included olives, olive oils, spices, and then certain nuts. And included in that were pistachios.
Which was kind of rare in America at that time. In fact, absolutely rare in America. How did the company go from a grocer to having pistachios as the chief product?
Well, my grandfather had a number of brothers and sisters, and they're all in the grocery business. My grandfather, Frank Sr., decided to focus just on pistachios. So that was one product that was relatively new, and he felt that there'd be enough of a market with pistachios in the United States to focus basically just on that nuts and then eventually other nuts.
At the beginning, you were importing all of them. Now, pistachios, for the most part, your supply comes from California. I mean, did Germack just effectively create a new agricultural industry in America?
Well, what they found was pistachios need a very dry climate, and they need a lot of sunshine, and they can't really survive well in very cold or moist climates. Mm-hmm. So Central California and Southern California had the ideal climate. And the cost to bring nuts from California distribute them across the United States versus importing them was significantly different and much more beneficial to the local crops. Now, one thing about pistachio trees, they take about 10 to 15 years to reach a point where they can produce high-quality, large pistachios. So it did take some time, and these crops were planted in the 60s. They really didn't come online in the United States until the 70s.
Oh, so they didn't start planting trees until the 60s.
That's correct.
That might be earlier than that. Now, I'm old enough, I remember red-dyed pistachios from my childhood, and I was reading and thought, your family started that. How'd that come about?
Sure. So the way pistachios
used— we're talking about the shells. The shells of the pistachios were dyed red, yeah.
That's correct. And so when pistachios were harvested, and this really goes back in time, so from the 20s all the way till about the 70s and into the 80s, pistachios were picked by hand. So folks would go into the— groves, and every pistachio has an outer husk, and the outer husk has kind of like a reddish tinge to it. As they pick them from the trees, some of that reddish color would go through the husk and onto the pistachio shell.
So it'd have a little stain.
Correct.
Okay.
And so if you saw a bowl of them, you'd see a number of them with this reddish stain. So they were dyed red for two reasons. Number one, to make them all look more uniform and to cover up that reddish stain. But really is also to make them look more appealing, to make them look more like develop the aesthetics of the product. And since they're relatively new to a lot of people, to make them look more appetizing and interesting.
You roast your pistachios a little differently than other companies do. What do you do different?
When the company started in the 20s, there was no such thing as mechanical pistachio roasters. What you had at the time were coffee roasters. So we use, or we did use, and we still use to this day, large capacity coffee roasters to roast pistachios. These roast up to about 250 pounds a batch. A batch takes about 40 minutes. Reason we do that, twofold. Number one, many of our competitors will buy nuts already roasted from California because the price is about the same. We believe that if we can bring them in and roast them, they're going to have a much fresher taste. Similar to bread coming out of the oven, it's going to taste that much better. And the same thing happens with pistachios. Moisture can start to degrade pistachios over time. It's an organic product, and that flavor starts to dissipate. So the fresher the roast, the better.
In the company's 95-year history, you've moved around Detroit a few times, but now your retail store is back pretty darn close to where the company started in Eastern Market. How do you feel about that?
The company started in Eastern Market in 1924. We were right behind the Stroh Brewery.
Although beer and pistachios go
together. They do go together. And so that was they are complementary products. In the 70s, the Stroh Brewery expanded and they needed our land.
Right.
So we had to move from that location. We did move to another part of Detroit, which was considered what was called Pole Town. And within a couple of years, General Motors and the City of Detroit decided that they needed the land.
You guys are getting pushed up by all the big boys.
Exactly. They need the land for their new GM factory, which is now, interestingly, perhaps going to shut down. We'll see. And then we eventually moved back to the Eastern Market.
During these 95 years, you've stayed in Detroit. It's been a city in flux. Why not move to where the pistachios are being grown in California or where the big urban centers are? Why'd you stay in Detroit?
Well, great question. We're loyal to Detroit. That's where the company started. It's a hub for us, so we can distribute easily from downtown Detroit. It's also important for us to remain identified with the city. We provide peanuts to the Detroit sports teams, but the company was started there. We employ almost everyone from this. Almost all of our employees are from Detroit, so we're very loyal, and it would be easier to move to a suburb if you consider things as, you know, City of Detroit taxes and so forth. But we just won't. We're going to stay in the city.
So you've got 5 years to your centennial. What are you planning?
Boy, that's a secret. But since we just got done with 95 and we've got 5 years, I think we've got some time to plan. But 100 will be very significant. We work with Detroit Historical. We know that they have a celebration for companies that reach 100 years. So we'll certainly be in touch with them, and certainly hope to be back on the radio with you and and get the word out on pistachios and everything we're doing as well.
Frank Jermak III and his family are third-generation owners of Jermak Pistachio Company, which is celebrating its 95th year in business this week. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock. Speaking of nuts, our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, welcome Laura, and Joey Horan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.